Welcome to Njota Talks. I am Omenihu Amachi. Njota Talks, a program of art bearing witness to human upliftment. We're on blog. My guest today is Dr. Oke Ndibe. Oke Ndibe teaches fiction and African literature at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He is the author of the novel Arrows of Rain, which has drawn praise from numerous critics and authors, including Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka, John Edgar Wideman, Michael Thelwell, and Nimi Osunbere. UK-based New International Magazine describes Arrows of Rain as a powerful and gritty debut. The magazine also spotlighted Arrows in its October 2001 special edition on New Fiction from the South. Ndibe also co-edited with Chenjerai Hove a book titled Writers Writing on Conflicts and Wars in Africa. Ndibe is lively, witty, and intellectually stimulating. His style has made him a highly sought-after speaker on Africa and African-American literature and politics. After studying business management at the Institute of Management and Technology, Enugu in Nigeria, Ndibe earned an MFA and PhD in English from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He has taught at Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut, where the Student newspaper named him one of the college's five outstanding professors, and Simon's Rock College of Bard in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, winning the college's New Faculty Award. During the 2001 to 2002 year, he was a Fulbright Scholar at the University of Lagos, Nigeria. Ndibe was the founding editor of African Contemporary, a magazine published in the U.S. by novelist Chinua Achebe, author of the classic novel Things Fall Apart. From 2000 to 2001, he served on the editorial board of Hartford, Connecticut, Hartford Court, where his piece titled Eyes to the Ground, The Perils of the Black Student, won the 2001 Association of Opinion Page Editors Award for Best Opinion Essay in an American newspaper. He also won a Best Opinion Piece Award from the Society of Professional Journalists, Connecticut chapter. Ndibe writes a weekly column for The Sun of Nigeria, and his opinion essays are carried by numerous websites. He contributes to several publications in the U.S., England, and elsewhere, including Hartford Courant, the Fabian Society, the Fabian Society Journal, Black Issues Book Review, BBC Online, www.guernicamag.com, and www.drunkenboat.com. Ndibe is finishing his second novel titled Foreign Gods Incorporated, and also working on a memoir of his life in the U.S. Dr. Oke Ndibe, welcome to Njota Talks.
Thank you very much.
Let's go straight to the question. Did you have a revelation, or were your achievements up to now planned out?
Ask that question again.
I'm asking.
Yes.
With all your accomplishments so far,
yes.
How did you start? Did you have a revelation, divine intervention, or were your achievements planned out, you know, from childhood to current?
Yes. Well, I wish, first of all, you're very generous in your praise. I'm not sure at all that I'll call myself yet a man of any significant accomplishment. One's hope is to ultimately make a mark, both as a novelist as well as a memoirist. There's still a long way to go on that road. But having said that, I must say that I've been extremely lucky, both from my parents, who gave all their five children a sense of the importance of education, and therefore inspired in us a love of books in general, but literature in particular. I have also been particularly lucky to have informal teachers. I never studied. I didn't study literature, but business management in college in Nigeria. But even so, I was inspired by the writings of numerous African writers, especially Chinua Achebe, Wole Soyinka, Ayikwe Ama, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, and other writers like Kofi Awono. So I would say that I've been very lucky, both in the kind of emphasis that my parents encouraged in reading, as well as the kind of informal teachers that I had, models really, in extraordinarily gifted African writers.
Okay. You have lived a life so far of accomplishment, even though you are modest about it, which is fine. It is an equal quality, that modesty. And looking at what you've written so far, I've been researching some of your writings, and one of those writings is called My Biafran Eyes.
Yes.
Okay. You received compliments such as Best Novel of 2011 and Conversations with History in the 1970s. Recount for us, for our listeners, if you will, the horror story of the Biafra War and how it affected your family, and how hope brought healing to you and your family.
Yes. I was a child of about 6 years old when Nigeria convulsed with the violence that ultimately led to the Biafran War. And I was born like the first four of us were born in Yola, which is in present Adamawa State, where my father was a postal clerk in Jimeta, Yola, and my mother was a school teacher at St. Teresa's Elementary School, again in Jimeta. And so my first memories were formed in Yola, and as a child I spoke excellent Hausa, and I couldn't have known that I was different in any way from the other kids, you know, who were of Hausa and Fulani descent and backgrounds and so on. So Hausa was my main language. I spoke Igbo as well as a child, but I would suspect that I was more adept at Hausa. And my earliest memories were of my father's colleague, a malam who worked with my father as a messenger in the post office, and who would often visit our house, and he had a beard. And I loved to sit on his knees and pull at his beard, which had a sprinkling of gray, you see. Mm-hmm. And then there was a tree just outside our home, which was in the called the Postal Quarters. So there was a tree that, as a child, I used to see as a huge, massive tree, except that 3 years ago when I went back to Yola, that same tree was still there, but it turned out that it's quite a small tree, you know, I guess with the perspective of a grown person. And so as Nigeria began to slip slowly but assuredly toward civil war, my father made a decision to send that my mother should take us, the children, four of their children, home to Amorbia, in current Anambra State. My father had to stay back because, as a civil servant, he had instructions there not to move. Civil servants were told not to abandon their posts or they risked losing their jobs. So my father stayed back. And it was a rather perilous journey back to the east by ship. I remember that on one occasion the ship got stuck in sand, and I remember people throwing coins into the river, the River Benue, as a kind of appeasement, I guess, to whatever spirit inhabited the river to let us go. But once we got back to Amorbia, my mother entered into a period of extreme mourning because she took it that she would never see her husband again. And she was, a young woman at the time, relatively. So for weeks and weeks, there was no communication from my father. And for me, it was bewildering to be cast in a new environment. And then one day, my father just showed up at home, and my mother had not eaten for days and weeks, and so she mostly lay down emaciated, very feeble, and suddenly somebody shouted, Elizao, Elizao, Digia Natao, which means Elizabeth, Elizabeth, your husband is home. My mom, weak as she was, sprang up from bed, and she saw this strange-looking person who had a very disheveled beard. My father was always clean-shaven, but the day he came back, he wore a beard. My mother flung herself at him and clasped him in an embrace, and very soon there were gunshots going all over my hometown. As people heard that my father had returned, they would just come outside and shoot into the air in celebration. After all, there was that perception that in fact the man had died. So this was the precursor to 30 months of extreme privation during the war itself, where we lived in as refugees in different towns and had very little food to eat, and upon it had to often at very short notice take cover in bushes and so on as Nigerian fighter jets swooped very close to towns and began to strafe people and cars and buildings with bombs and so on. So it was a particularly terrifying time for me as a child, and I have very vivid memories of so many moments in the war. And I'm working on a memoir of that those experiences.
That's a wonderful recount of the story in the book that you're writing. As a tribute to Art Bearing Witness, My Biafran Eyes. Now, the federal government you mentioned at the time were asking citizens not to leave. Was that intentional in your mind? Do you think now, looking back, that the federal government was intentional in that move, or was it that they did not realize that a massacre would ensue?
Well, I think that there were clearly signs that because a massacre had taken place, the first one had taken place already. But it's in the nature of governments to play down hazards and dangers and to project a sense of confidence in the stability of a polity. So clearly, those who were running the government at the time, I'm sure that if they were asked to place bets, would not have suggested seriously that massacres, further massacres, would not take place. But it was their duty, I think, to project the sense that Nigeria was returning to normalcy and to its old, really, you know, stable relations, as stable as one could say that Nigeria was in those days. So it is difficult to say whether this was an intentional policy to have people stay back or some people stay back so that they will become victims of the massacre. But you know, we also have to remember that the recently diseased Biafran leader, Dim Odumegwu Ojukwu, was also persuaded that things will return to normal, and he'd actually persuaded some Igbos to stay back or to return to to their northern locations, their lives will be safeguarded. And I don't think Ojukwu was part of any conspiracy to have his people killed. No.
Yes. Now, what was the trip like, the trip that you and your mother took to return to the East, Biafra at the time? Coins in the river is, I didn't think that things like that happened as a child. I know I've seen it out here in the West, but at the time I may not have understood it. What do you think?
Yes. Well, I remember I was about six and a half. So I don't have a memory of the entire trip, but there are poignant moments of that trip, and the most poignant, in my view, was when the boat that we were traveling in was caught in quicksand and could not budge, could not move. I think that what must have happened was that the boat must have docked so that people would get supplies and so on and so forth, and just got caught in sand. And so as it was dug out, literally dug out, there were people in the waters in canoes trying to dig it out. A lot of the adult passengers were throwing coins, you know, into the river. Sort of interesting ritual of bribing the river to be merciful. As you must know, some of our people believe that spirits inhabit rivers and so on, and so that if you expiate, make expiation sacrifices and so on, you could buy those spirits to let you apply the waters without coming to harm.
Okay. Just to let our listeners know that today on Njota Talks, we are talking to Dr. Oke Ndibe. He's an author and journalist. He's an activist and an educator. On Njota Talks today, Art Bearing Witness, we're looking also at the painting by myself, Omenihu Amachi. The painting is called War, Justice, and Occupy. And War, Justice, and Occupy examines the horror of war, such as the Biafra War, and it takes, to a larger extent, a look at the just-concluded wars and other wars and conflicts around the world. The painting Justice, War, Justice, and Occupy also speaks to the blind and often impartial arm of justice and the masses who find themselves faced with poverty and the inability to overcome hardship in spite of hard work and perseverance. The producer of the program, Njota Talks, is in the studio, and she is the publisher of Njota.org. So you're listening to Njota Talks on Blog Talk Radio, and my guest, Oke Ndibe, has also written the book, My Biafra Eyes.
My Biafran Eyes is an essay that I wrote, which I'm turning as we speak into a book, so it's not quite a book yet. Okay. My book is Arrows of Rain, and I just finished work on another novel called Foreign Gods Incorporated.
Okay. Today I looked at the excerpts of the book, and it talks to me about how we're talking about My Biafra Eyes. I was actually referring to your other book, which is
Arrows
your other essay, which is called not Arrows of Rain, but rather Foreign Gods Incorporated.
Foreign Gods Incorporated.
And it is a Guernica publication at the moment,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah.
And it's also a work in progress. Okay. After reading that publication, I felt as if I was one with the writer in the quest to understand the God business and also to a large extent to navigate the business as an artist. So my question is, was it fiction or non-fiction?
Well, it is fiction. A few years ago, actually, it's fiction that came from a moment of lived experience. Some years ago, a cousin of mine went to Nigeria, and on his return, told me of a community where the wooden statue of a deity had disappeared, and nobody knew who took it. People were just bewildered at the disappearance. And so as a novelist, I began to think about what might have happened. And what I came up with initially was to write a novel where the deity that disappeared could have been taken by members of fundamentalist Christian sect sworn to destroy all such quote unquote pagan heathen gods. But as I began to write the novel, it seemed to me another more fascinating idea struck me, and which was to have there be a gallery in New York City called Foreign Gods Incorporated that buys and sells foreign gods and deities from around the world, sacred objects from around the world. And so that to have a Nigerian go home to his village to steal a village deity that used to be a god of war to sell it to this gallery. And so it's fiction, but its seeds, if you like, came from a story, a real life story that a cousin of mine told me.
Yes, and also as symbols, these gods are viewed in the sculptures and the carvings and figurines that are today marketed around the world. Some of these symbols, these artworks are also seen as symbols of fertility and healing, symbols of peace and so on.
Definitely there are. Can I jump in for a minute?
Go ahead.
I was going to say that after I published that one chapter on GuernicaMag.com, I actually received two interesting responses. One was from a Nigerian who told me that there was actually a Nigerian gallery, a gallery owned by a Nigerian somewhere in Massachusetts that indeed sells guards that are pushed from different African communities. And then a colleague of mine, an American professor, also showed me a story, a report in the New Yorker magazine of the arrest of an Indian, smuggler who would go through Indian shrines and steal the heads of different divinities to sell them in different parts of Europe. Anybody who has wandered into certain shops that retail African art will see that some of the objects that have been sold definitely have aspects, ritual aspects, and so therefore were used at some point for religious purposes by those who worshipped in certain ways.
Yeah. So, in other words, could you say that this $1 million business is an embrace of pagan gods?
It seemed to me part of what I tried to do in the novel is to show how we have globalization has meant the consumption, how we consume one another's illusions, and so there is a certain fascination in Europe and in America with what's called quote unquote the primitive. So you find extremely wealthy people who want to go to Kenya or go to Ghana or go to Nigeria, not in the same way that they want to go to a European country on vacation, but they sort of feel that they are entering the primitive, the sort of the strange, the exotic, and so on. And then you go to a lot of African countries and other developing countries, and you find a fascination with fast food, you see, because people think this is the way that Americans eat. So if we want to become Americans, we have to eat fast food, and without realizing how bad this food is for them. And so part of what I do in this novel is to examine the ways in which we become interested in consuming our illusions of what the other is, you see. And clearly, you know, there is that the commodification, the ways that in which the spiritual sphere, the religious sphere, is turned into an area of marketing. You know, so gods are marketed and sacred objects are marketed and so on. Yes.
Yeah. Indeed, a business in the marketing of gods. What a concept. Dr. Kendibe is my guest on Mjota Talks today on Blog Talk Radio. And the art I'm featuring is War, Justice, and Occupy. It is an acrylic painting. It's 16 by, what is the size on this piece? Is 16 by 20. I almost forgot the size of my own painting. And it is an acrylic painting, painted on canvas. And I use several techniques in my work, I use drips and pulls and pushes and drabs and drags and on occasion flaps here and there to create the effect that I need. And in my work, you can see motifs, different kinds of motifs. Some borrowed from the Igbo cultural scripts and motifs. And some I make up according to how I feel and the plants and objects and symbols of the Igbo people, from where comes Dr. Kendibe, who is my guest today on Mjota Talks on Blog Talk Radio. And we're talking about his book, his writing, Foreign Gods Incorporated. And I look at this work as a very ingenious, very interesting story. And it brings me to the idea whether the Igbo, the Biafra folklore, is in an era of Igbo African Renaissance. Maybe what's your take on that?
Well, there is a talk of an African Renaissance, and my reaction to that is one of both fascination but also skepticism. I think that talk of a Renaissance is it's a particularly European way of looking at things, where people are said to have arrived or to be on the rise and so on in terms of their intellectual and social and cultural productions. I think that every people are in a permanent state of Renaissance, that there's always creativity, there's always a reproduction of their lives that is going on, that there's never a time when a people altogether lose that capacity for cultural enlargement. So I am hesitant to borrow terms like cultural renaissance. But having said that, I must also agree that in recent years there has been great flowering, a great production of cultural work in Nigeria, in Igbo land, in Africa. Clearly, in the area of writing, African and Nigerian and Igbo writers have been doing extraordinary work, which is catching the attention of the world in new ways. And lots of Nigerian musicians, Igbo musicians, are making a mark in the world. And the same goes for visual artists, you know, who are sticking out a claim to both national, continental, and international attention. So if there is a renaissance, I think we can speak of a renaissance in that context. But the people are always reproducing themselves, and they're always wrestling with their lives. And in that process of wrestling, they're producing in significant and remarkable histories and so on.
Excuse me. Now, you write a weekly column for Sahara Reporters.
Yes.
Sahara Reporters, you might want to explain, are relatively new online, and they do a lot of good stories on what is happening in Nigeria and around the world concerning Igbo and Nigerians. And then you were arrested and actually harassed when you returned to Nigeria. Did this have anything to do with your writings? And Fawenyimi.
Yes.
Did any of that have to do with your mishap in Nigeria when you traveled?
There's no question. I don't think I was arrested because I'm a professor in the U.S. Because I teach a class in African literature. I teach a fiction class. Clearly, my weekly columns, which focus on Nigeria, and examine some of the country's painful, disappointing moments and the tragic choices that are made mostly by Nigerian leaders, so-called Nigerian leaders, but also by the Nigerian people as well. I think that those writings, which appear on Sahara Reporters, as well as in The Sun newspaper, as well as a few other newspapers in Nigeria, that those weekly meditations on the compulsions of African, and specifically Nigerian, contemporary yes. experience earned me inclusion on a rather weird, bizarre list that is called Enemies of the State. And I was told that the Yar'Adua government had put me on that list, but somehow the Jonathan government has not found a way to remove me from that list. Yes.
Okay, very good. I was going to ask about that, but glad to hear that it was resolved without further, let me say, ado for... can't find a better word.
Well, my name is still on the list. So whenever I go into Nigeria, I was first detained briefly in January. I went back in June to give a talk at the University of Nigeria, and I was detained at the airport again briefly, but with a plea not to write about it because apparently after the officer who detained me made calls to Abuja to his superiors. They were not enthusiastic to receive the same kind of international condemnation that trailed the original detention in January. But whenever I've gone in or outside of Nigeria since January of last year, I've had to go. To be taken to the offices of the SSS at the airport.
So
it's not altogether resolved, yes.
Yeah, what I'm saying, though, is would it not be to their own advantage to immediately take your name off that list, for nothing else, for the work that you're doing, which is good work, considering that it helps humanity?
Well, no. As far as the official Nigerian position is concerned, the work I'm doing is not good. When a system is corrupt and you are opposed to corruption, that system doesn't give you medals for fighting corruption. They would harass you for doing it. They would much rather that I accepted bribes here and there and turned a blind eye to what they do. Well, I'm constitutionally incapable of accepting inducement of any sort. Not even would I accept a bribe to do something that is right. So I'll definitely not accept a bribe to do something that is wrong. And so, no, the Nigerian government doesn't see me as doing anything good at all. But I still have to do what I have to do,
obviously,
regardless. Obviously. And you know, part of the reason they haven't removed my name, I guess, is partly incompetence. You know, that they are very quick in putting names on the list to harass innocent citizens, but they become absolutely inept when it comes to doing the right thing by removing the name. The other thing is that I actually, since there is a list, and I imagine that it's mostly innocent Nigerians who are on that list, I'm not particularly pushing it for my name to be removed. If the Nigerian government must do the right thing, the right thing is to destroy that list altogether. There shouldn't be. Yeah. The only person who should be on a list is somebody who has committed crimes, not innocent mm-hmm. citizens who oppose crimes in their country.
Absolutely. Okay. You do know Chinua Achebe and Wole Soyinka. You mentioned them on your online pages what you've worked with them on occasion. Do you think that what is going on in Nigeria today, that writers and the press and the media are doing enough to, you know, bring this information out and to encourage a more positive economy and society?
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned showing Canada Chebe, it's important that we emphasize that they are not just your ordinary Nigerian writer. These are some of the most important writers that our contemporary world knows. And they have served Nigeria with great merit, and they to the extent that Nigeria has made a positive impact in the world, I think that impact has come from the work of writers like Achebe, like Soyinka, like the Chiamadi and Flora Nwapa, and so on, you know, and also from the work of its great artists, musicians, painters, and so on. Now, to come to the other arm of your question, no, I definitely think that the Nigerian media and the Nigerian intellectual class have betrayed their mission and their duty to clarify a vision for the country that they in recent years that media practitioners in Nigeria have lent themselves as accomplices in the destruction of Nigeria, basically. To read Nigerian newspapers newspapers today, you would not recognize that most of our governors, most of our ministers, and so on, are in the business of stealing the nation blind. I think that politicians have found a way of buying influence with the media. And so the more they steal, the more some sections of the press will sing praises and will give them awards that have absolutely no legitimacy and no significance.
Yes. Now, how unfortunate. Now, just for those who may not know, Nigeria is Africa's most populous nation and is a continent with the second largest economy and leading oil producer, I believe. And despite its wealth in natural resources, most of the citizens live on less than $1 or $2 a day. And often cited as Africa's greatest hope, Nigeria, has long been held back by endemic corruption and sectarian religious conflict. And most recently, it is seen in the Christmas Day bombing in northern Nigeria by the radical Islamic sect Boko Haram that left over 20 killed and scores more maimed and hospitalized. And also today, there is demonstration on the streets in Nigeria and calls for change on account of the fuel subsidy. So in your mind, you know, in your mind as a journalist, as an activist, as a professor, are these aftermaths of unhealed wounds, you know, of maybe a civil Biafran war or something else?
Well, two things. I don't see a dichotomy at all. I think that the current tragedies of Nigeria's experience are rooted in the war that we fought, in the amnesia that we permitted to mask our memory of that war. So there are there are pathologies in Nigerian history. There are moments of great of great betrayals, if you like, of the Nigerian people by their leadership. Okay, that moment has been it has a long running tradition. That one of the first things Nigerian so-called Nigerian leaders do is to promise Nigerians that they will that there will be prosperity in the future. But then these leaders don't wait for the future in order to gratify themselves. They steal immediately, and they buy themselves mansions, and they buy themselves private jets, and they buy themselves mansions around the world, and cars, and so on and so forth. And of course, Nigerians wake up in the future to find out that their lives have become worse. And so what's going on now is that the Jonathan administration has removed so-called fuel subsidy. And there's an important and fundamental debate whether there's actually anything called fuel subsidy in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. A lot of knowledgeable people will tell you that what we have is corruption that unmasks itself as a fuel subsidy, that there's no fuel subsidy, right? Okay. We have deliberately pursued a policy of undermining our refineries so that we would import fuel, refined fuel into the country. And there's a lot of corruption that is attached to that process. The government could have addressed that corruption and stopped it. Instead of which, in a country where the minimum wage is 18,000 Naira, they have created a situation where to go from Lagos to Onitsha, you pay 10,000 Naira one way. So that a man takes his month's salary, okay, if a man wants to travel from Lagos to Onitsha, which is on the first leg of his trip, maybe to a hometown in Anambra State or Imo State, his salary would not be enough to pay the transport fare for even two members of his family. Okay? Meanwhile, the Nigerian president spends 1 billion naira on his feeding alone. Okay? We all know that in the United States that the president of the United States buys his own meals, pays for his own personal meals, pays for his toiletries, okay? That the president of the U.S. enjoys free meals only when there is a state function, okay? Otherwise, he has to, from his salary, buy meals, food for his children and family, you see? So we have a very skewed system where President Jonathan is now telling Nigerians that he needs to save the money that went into fuel subsidy in order to transform Nigeria. Okay? But he's not waiting. He's not behaving like a president of a poor country. You know, he's spending a lot of money on his feeding. He's spending a lot of money on his medical treatment and treatment for his family, and this treatment is got abroad, see, not in Nigeria. And so Nigerians are not buying it. But to return again to your larger question, Nigeria is a country that fought a civil war in which we lost between 1.5 to 2 million people. But as soon as we finished fighting that war, we continued to carry on as if that war was not fought. So we have not allowed the lessons of the war to inform and to shape what we do and our lives. And so we're caught in this cyclical, tragic vortex. And unless we have a combination of luck and vision and real positive action, the country could find itself in a terrible place quickly.
Yes, I wanted to for you to talk briefly about you know, mentioning the state of in our infrastructure and educational system,
yeah.
But we're quickly coming to the last minutes of the show, and
yeah.
I wanted you also to, you know, Chinua Achebe, who you mentioned earlier,
yes.
won the award as the man of the year.
Yes.
You know, those were the issues I wanted you to, but just pick and choose whichever you may, what you want to talk about at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Achebe endeared himself to Nigerians when, for the second time in about 7 years, he rejected so-called national honor that was given to him by President Jonathan. It is important that the Nigerian government recognize that what they call national honor has lost any meaning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That there are every year that they put on that role of so-called national honor, men and women who have actually worked actively to destroy the country, and therefore men who should belong in jail rather than men who are honored. And so to ask Achebe to keep that particularly callous and an unattractive company was to underestimate Achebe's
okay.
sense of moral clarity. And so Achebe made a statement in a three-sentence statement where he rejected the national honor, and in fact he then became the champion of all Nigerians, and we're all proud of him.
Yes, we are all proud of him. His book, Things Fall Apart, is a favorite, even in American and British schools around the world.
Yes.
People
yes.
read Things Fall Apart, and people give him honor and respect for what he has accomplished.
Yes.
Do you think that he will accept to interview with us on Jot?
I can't speak for him. Definitely, it's I'll have him. If you want, I'll approach him on your behalf.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. But I can't presume to give an answer for him. But I do know. One thing I do know is that he's courted by so many. Media people from around the world. So he's, I know that his portfolio of requests is huge to do interviews from newspapers and television and radio from all over the world. So, but you never know. You never know.
You never know. Yeah. Now, before we round up, we talked about the Biafra War and you and your family.
Yes.
Just going back to that, you and your family, your escape from the
yes.
north, from the north to Igbo land,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to go back there, and during the war there was sickness and starvation,
mm-hmm.
and the Catholic Church, did they play a role? Did they play an adequate role? Could they have done more in the saga of the war in helping save lives and so on, food
yes.
and so on?
The Catholic Church played a very positive role. You can always ask more of somebody, and so I have no doubt that they could have done more. But with the resources that they had, I think that they did an extraordinary job of bringing relief to Nigerians, to embattled Biafran, and also highlighting the savage tactics that the Nigerian government used against defenseless civilians during the war. So the Catholic Church was a voice of conscience, and offered much succor and relief to Biafrans. So So there were priests, there were lay Catholics who took grave risks to ensure that relief materials got across to the Biafran territory that was increasingly isolated and closed off by the Nigerian military.
Yeah, and there were actually some countries that had recognized Biafra during that time who
yes.
were also very helpful in one way or the other.
Yes, absolutely.
And these are little known by people today.
Yes. No, it's important that we reinforce the memory of our people about the war. Not just the memory of Biafrans, but the memory of those who were on the other side. It's painful for me to encounter Nigerians who are in their 30s and some of them in their 40s, whose perception of the war is painfully simplistic. You see. Who would tell you, oh, the war was started by Ojukwu or it was started by Gawon, you know, and who, it's a war that was fought on that scale and where so much of that was at stake. Our historians, our novelists, our memoir writers, our teachers need to make that war a central part of the conversation, of the discourse, of the air that we breathe.
It should be in our history books.
Precisely, it should permeate the pores of our citizens. Because I think that what has happened, say in the Niger Delta, the economic injustice in the Niger Delta, the environmental degradation in the Niger Delta has been made possible precisely by us Nigerians forgetting what happened in Biafra.
Yeah.
Okay? If we had a sharp and strong memory of the Biafran War and what it represented, then Nigerians will be rather reluctant to flirt with the prospect of another civil war. That every day we've done things that are so provocative, just the bombing of innocent people
sure.
who are coming out from church on Christmas Day.
Okay. Yes.
That bombing alone in a lot of countries will precipitate a war, a horrific war. And yet Nigerians undergo that kind of provocation on an almost daily basis. And I think it's because we have easily erased the memory of the Biafran War.
Yes. High Chief MC Oji, Malaki Oji, is one of the leaders of the Igbo community here in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
He is actually online. He has called into the show. And I was wondering, High Chief, if you can hear us, do you have a word or a question you would like to ask Dr. Kendibe?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Mechi. Dr. Oke, believe me, you have a very good, brilliant idea about what happened during the war and after the war, and what is happening now. I'm really jubilant to hear all you said. It's very encouraging. And I think you said it all. Believe you me, what is happening there now is disheartening. And I don't know where we have to start from. It is difficult to remember what happened during the Nigerian-Biafran War. We don't want to recollect that experience, but never mind, it is worthy of remembering. At all rate, what advice would you give President Jonathan right now as regards this fuel subsidy issue?
First of all, Jonathan had no business removing fuel subsidy. I wrote two or three columns where I said that if Jonathan wants to save money, he should for once save money from himself and also from Nigeria's political leaders. We must remember that every Nigerian governor, 36 of them, each one of them receives each month between $2.5 and $3.5 million in what they call security vote. That's a scam. The governors simply pocket this money. The U.S. President Obama earns 400,000 naira in dollars in a year. Therefore, each month, a Nigerian governor gets enough money to pay Obama's salary 5 to 6 times Obama's annual salary. Okay, and that money is pocketed. Every Nigerian senator and every member of the House of Representatives gets between 1.7 and gets 1.7 million and 1.4 million dollars every quarter, every 3 months, in what they call constituency allowance. We again know, because these payments are not audited, that most of the legislators pocket that money. So on the one hand, you cannot say to Nigerians that we don't have money, and yet you are paying what you call security vote to the president and to governors, and you're paying constituency allowance, and the Nigerian president has all his needs, every meal that he eats and his family eats, their vacations, they have private, they have presidential jets available to them. So Nigerians pay for everything that the Nigerian president enjoys, that the Nigerian governor enjoys, that the legislators enjoy. And you want to punish Nigerians who earn minimum wage of 18,000. You want them to pay more in terms for fuel. It is evil. It's not just... So my advice to Jonathan was in my columns. I said, if you are serious about the economic problems in the country, fight corruption seriously, okay? Government officials steal enough that if you stopped it and if you tried, prosecuted and jailed those that you can convict and recouped what they've stolen, Nigeria will be awash with cash. That's where you go if you're a serious leader. But of course, Jonathan doesn't want to contemplate all of that because his friends and himself and others are implicated in the destruction of Nigeria.
Yeah, Doctor, there's another thing I want to ask you, actually. What is your thinking about privatization of federal and state government establishments like Nigeria Airways, like there are two or three state companies we have in Imo State. They have all been sold to private individuals. What is your opinion about that? And look at another one is again this Volkswagen manufacturing company in Kokomako area of Lagos State. My greatest surprise, they showed on television now they use that fat big company as a warehouse for selling palm oil to transporting the palm oil to Asia and Europe. What actually do you think about privatization of those governmental establishments in Nigeria that is supposed to be the mass production of infant absorbing these school leavers, university graduates? That is where they should get jobs. What is your thinking about that?
Okay, I'm not necessarily opposed to privatization. Now, my worry is that these government-owned, previously government-owned establishments are given to cronies of those in power for at a huge discount. So it's actually therefore corruptly transferred, you see, to private hands. I think that in Nigeria, the history of government-run businesses is not a very impressive one. because what happens ultimately is that the minister fills these establishments with people from his area or relatives of his who are not necessarily qualified and who behave in whatever way they want because they feel our benefactor is a minister. You are not going to do anything to us. So you found that when Nigeria ran the Nigeria Airways, it was losing money every year, and every year government will vote money and put in there, and if they appoint some people into the board, and they will just go and share the money, put it in their pocket. So when Nigeria had fees, landing fees to pay, they didn't pay it because the money had been stolen. When planes needed to be repaired and so on, there was no money to repair them. But when you have private individuals running these businesses, right, they know that they have to repair their planes, they know that they have to motivate the staff in order to make money, and that they have to leave on time and so on and so forth. And so services become better. So what we should guard against is the willful transfer of government resources to individuals for peanuts, okay? So we should get a fair price, a fair deal, if we're selling these enterprises, okay? And we should also insist that those who buy the businesses should continue, should keep them open and should continue to create jobs rather than situations where some buyers of government businesses got its assets and sell the assets and then move on, you see. Yeah.
Yes, on that note, I would want to let our listeners know that they've been listening to Njota Talks on Blog Talk Radio. Dr. Oke Ndibe has been my guest today. Dr. Oke Ndibe teaches fiction and African literature at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's an author and writer, and he's the author of the novel Arrows of Rain. Dr. Ndibe has been with us today on Blog Talk Radio, and we are thrilled that he has been with us here today. I have been presenting to you also my painting, which is a 16 by 20 acrylic, I call War, Justice, and Occupy. And it speaks to the injustices and the upliftment of the human spirit. High Chief MC Orji has also been on the line with us and has come in with a couple of questions for our guests. And also in the studio has been the publisher of Mjota.org and Dr. Susanna Hudson, and myself, Omenihu Amachi. I want to say thank you very much, Dr. Oke Ndibe, for being with us today on Mjota Talks.
Thank you very much, Amachi.
And also to MC Orji, High Chief MC Orji is an aeronautics engineer, and he worked with Nigerian Airways, and he assured that airplanes flying out of Nigeria and out of America here, London, in New York, were well maintained. And he's also a businessman who works and lives here in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. Thank you very much, MC Orji, High Chief, for being on the show today.
Thank you, Amechi, and thank you, Dr. K. It's my pleasure hearing your voice today.
It's my pleasure hearing yours, too. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. And until next week, when we bring you another edition of Mjota Talks on Blog Talk Radio, this is your host, Omenihu Amachi, saying thank you for listening and be with us again. You can also listen to our programs on podcast. Just dial into Mjota Talks. go online, dial into Njata Talks.org, and you can find us. Thank you.